today. So I'm hoping to be able to put together a short quiz based on some of the lectures. And then I will write a comprehensive final exam for anyone who wants to take this for credit, and in particular for anyone who wants to be graded. Any of you who are homeschooling or something like that, and you want to take an exam based on what you've read, based on what we've talked about over the last 4 weeks, and what we will talk about over the next 2.5 or 3 weeks, you'll have that opportunity. So we introduced the topic. We introduced questions about capitalism and socialism and the mixed economy, and then we spent a good deal of time 2 weeks ago talking about, very specifically, Mises' article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. We talked about that, we talked about Hayek, and we talked about the fundamental insight that they bring to the table, which says basically that in the absence of private ownership of the means of production, you cannot have rational economic calculation. When there's a disconnect between the goods that people are consuming and the goods that are being used in the production of those goods that people are consuming, then we cannot literally figure out how we should allocate scarce inputs for the production of outputs. Mises makes what I think is a very, very strong argument, a very strong argument. He says, well, let's assume that somehow we know exactly what to produce, exactly how to produce it, exactly how to distribute it. And we also know all of the possible technological combinations of resources that we can use to, in fact, produce the goods and services that people ultimately demand. Finally, we know not just the technology, and we know not just what we're supposed to be producing, we also know the natural resources. We know we have a complete inventory of our natural resources, we know all of the technologically feasible ways to produce, and we know exactly what we should be producing. Tying all of this together is a central planning board, or a group of surrogates who are able to again, figure out what we should be producing and all these technological combinations, and they have precisely the correct incentives. They don't care about maximizing their own well-being necessarily. They're in it solely for the good of the society. They're in it solely for the good of the state. And we're going to talk a little bit about the practical consequences, though, of socialism this evening. So here's a very, very brief outline. According to a lot of economists, the world began in 1776 when Adam Smith published his Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. So we're going to talk a bit about self-interest and how that translates into the wealth of nations, and then also some of the criticisms of self-interest and some of the implications of the socialist doctrine that socialism or communism would transcend self-interest and transcend all of the things that make this a lousy and difficult and awful world in which to live. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about some of Marx's criticisms of Smith and of classical economics. We'll talk about a couple of different kinds of socialism, and we'll talk about the practical consequences of some of these types of socialism. In addition, in deriving from Mises and Hayek, and to a degree, some of the chapters in Hoppe, we're going to go back a little bit and talk about Karl Menger. We're going to talk about what he contributed to our understanding of the social world. I taught Chapter 3 of Menger's Principles of Economics in my Econ 323 Classical and Marxian Political Economy course a week ago. And as I was reading this, it sort of hit me like a ton of bricks that three of the most important ideas in all of social science are embedded in this one chapter of Menger. So what we'll do is we'll talk a little bit about Menger, his method, and the implications of his method for how we understand economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth, and also how we understand desirable and indeed even possible social institutions. Finally, we're going to talk about Hayek and the knowledge problem. And we'll talk a little bit about an essay that James, a very, very short essay that James Buchanan, who is himself very heavily influenced by Mises and Hayek, wrote called Order Defined in the Process of Its Emergence. And we're going to talk about what exactly it means for something to be part of the means of production. And we'll ask whether it's even possible to talk about and define the means of production independent of the process of market exchange. Let's continue. We'll discuss self-interest and the wealth of nations. Because according to a lot of people, you know, self-interest is something that is to be overcome. Self-interest is an expression of internal vice. Self-interest is something that we should not indulge. Self-interest is something that is indeed something to be condemned. Generally, when people think of self-interest, they think of material self-interest, or they think of selfishness, meaning that we're going to increase our material standard of living no matter who we have to run over, no matter what evil, terrible, awful things we have to do, and we care about no one other than ourselves. One of the implications of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, and one of the implications of carefully done economics, is when people pursue their variously conceived self-interests, we end up at an outcome that is no part of anyone's design. It's an outcome that no one intends. It's an outcome that no one plans. But nonetheless, it works to the benefit of everyone. A lot of people think that this is kind of naive. They say, oh, well, you know, economists have a sort of airy-fairy notion that self-interest leads to socially optimal outcomes. If you saw the movie A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe, he's playing John Nash, and they're at a bar. They're sitting at a bar in Princeton, and they're talking about how to pick up women. And Nash comes up with he devises his famous Nash equilibrium. The movie completely butchers all of this, but anyway, his pickup point is when one of his colleagues says, "Remember your Adam Smith, gentlemen. You know, when we all pursue our self-interest, this maximizes social welfare." Nash says, "No, what we need to do is find a way to cooperate." Adam Smith was wrong. You see Russell Crowe pick up his flurry of papers and he rushes off to go and do something, to go and say brilliant things. This I think is an unfortunate and naive reading of Adam Smith. But even beyond this, I think we can think in slightly greater detail about what self-interest means, what self-interest does, and what it implies about the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. So here's a famous passage from Smith in which he talks precisely about self-interest. So Smith writes, "But the annual revenue of every society is always precisely equal to the exchangeable value of the whole annual produce of its industry, or rather is precisely the same thing with that exchangeable value. As every individual, therefore, endeavors as much as he can both to employ his capital in the support of domestic industry, and so to direct that industry that its produce may be of the greatest value, every individual necessarily labors to render the annual revenue of the society as great as he can. He generally, indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest, nor knows how much he is promoting it. By preferring the support of domestic to that of foreign industry, he intends only his own security. And by directing that industry in such a manner as its produce may be of the greatest value, he intends only his own gain. And he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Nor is it always the worse for the society that it was a part of it. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. I've never known much good done by those who affected to trade for the public good. It is an affectation, indeed, not very common among merchants, and very few words need to be employed in dissuading them from it." So to set the stage, and to set the story for the 19th century critiques of capitalism, and the Marxian criticisms of classical doctrines, we begin with Smith and his famous thesis about the invisible hand, and his famous thesis about how self-interest will lead us to an outcome which is no part of our intention, but which nonetheless promotes and maximizes the general commerce and the general well-being of the society. A lot of people take this as a moral claim, that Smith is not being a positive analyst here. He's not saying, he's not just saying this is what will happen if we do this. They think that Smith is making a prescriptive claim that people should only pursue their self-interest, that people should not necessarily care about one another, and that people should just look out for number one, let the chips fall where they may, and then if anybody slips through the proverbial cracks, then that's their fault. That's for them to worry about. That's no cause or no concern of mine. Some argue, indeed, that the implications of the Smithian system are for the very wealthy to get wealthier and for the poorer, and for the poor to either stay poor or indeed get poorer. You've probably heard the political slogan, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. And indeed, those who would criticize Smith, those who would criticize liberal laissez-faire economics, would say that it's essential to the capitalist mode of production that the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and the bourgeoisie and the upper class are able to almost literally extract surplus value from the flesh of the proletariat, from the flesh of the working class. It's argued that this is something to be demolished, perhaps. And indeed, this is a big part of Marx's political program, is toward a ruthless criticism of everything existing. He says, take that which exists, find some way to smash it, and that will then usher in the revolution. So self-interest leads to prosperity, according to Smith. According to Smith's critics, however, self-interest might not necessarily always lead to prosperity. And we can think about different scenarios in which Smith is right and in which Smith is wrong. So Smith says self-interest leads to an outcome which is no part of our intentions, but which generally benefits everybody. He can be right, he can be wrong. In the first case, he can be right when people have incentives to produce and exchange, when they have incentives to provide stuff that people want at prices they're willing to pay, when they have incentives to build better mousetraps, when they have incentives to cross oceans in order to bring, say, financial services to Chinese workers, and to bring iPads and iPods and iPhones to American consumers. In this case, everybody's going to be better off. When we have incentives to enrich ourselves by production and by exchange, then yes, everybody's better off. Smith can be wrong, however. Smith can be wrong when people have incentives to expropriate and redistribute. To expropriate means, again, to take things that don't belong to you. To redistribute just means to redistribute them among those who are presumably paying you for the benefits of that redistribution. When people have incentives to produce and exchange, we get economic growth. When people have incentives to expropriate and redistribute, we get not just a lack of economic growth, not just stagnation, but often direct economic decline. So the implication of the Smithian system is to get the institutions right, get the rules right. Douglas North, one of my mentors in graduate school, defined institutions according to as the formal rules, the informal norms, and the enforcement characteristics that make those rules and norms stick. In the process, he effectively developed a body of theory showing that when we have very, very good rules, we get Smith being right. People have incentives to produce and exchange. And the way that we get rich is to produce stuff that people want at prices that they're willing to pay. When the institutions are wrong, people are going to have incentives to expropriate and redistribute, and in so doing, they're going to make the society much poorer. So the implication of Smith is to get the institutions right, get the rules right, have private property, have free trade, and have unregulated exchanges between people who are cooperating voluntarily via the market process, and that then is the road to riches. Karl Marx disagreed. Marx specifically thought that self-interest, and indeed a lot of people who follow in the Marxian tradition, say that self-interest is a historically contingent fact about humanity, that self-interest is something that is perhaps produced by the historical evolution that has produced, or that went through primitivism, feudalism, capitalism, and then eventually socialism. So self-interest is something that's produced by specific historical forces, and it is indeed not a fundamental characteristic of human nature. Rather, it is something that can be transcended. It's a specific and unique, almost psychological malady produced by the capitalist mode of production. Marx, as we've said, following in the tradition of French socialists, British political economists, and German philosophers, developed an idea that eventually capitalism would be transcended and replaced by socialism or communism. And thus, everyone who followed after him tried to figure out exactly what the conditions were that would bring about the revolution, that would bring about the transition from capitalism to socialism. In one of his essays, Marx refers to communism as the positive transcendence of private property as human self-estrangement. So let's think about what that means for just a second. So first of all, private property, what does it mean for something to be private property? To own something means to have the right to exclude others from using it. I own my cup of tea here, therefore I can exclude you from drinking it. Property rights, as I generally think about them, are going to be a set of rules and norms that define who owns what and under what circumstances. So when we have private property, we have the ability to exclude others from using things. Specifically, when we have private property in the means of production, we get to decide how exactly those means of production are going to be used and how exactly those means of production are going to be employed for the production of future output. Marx's argument is that the abolition of private property, and indeed, he and Engels state in the Communist Manifesto that that's the essence of the communist program, is the complete abolition of private property. His argument is that the abolition of private property will lead to the transcendence of all of the social, psychological maladies of the private property capitalist economy. It will make us all whole again. It will help us to regain our souls. And indeed, communism will provide us with the positive transcendence of private property as human self-estrangement. So what is it? So what does human self-estrangement mean? What is meaningful about that? Well, according to Marx, when you think hard about what people bring to the market, the poorest of the poorest of the poor, they have nothing but their labor. All they own is their labor. So they come in. They labor on behalf of someone else's private property. They engage in a process of mixing their labor with someone else's property. The owners of what is produced will not be the laborers who do the manufacturing, but rather the capitalists and the owners of the means of production. So for example, if you have money in a 401k or money in a 403b or something to that effect, and it's invested in, say, Apple, then you have armies of Chinese workers, presumably, who are making iPhones and iPads that they will never themselves actually use. According to Marx, these resources, these finished goods, confront them as something alien. They're the embodiment of the labor of the laborers, but nonetheless, they're owned not by the workers themselves, but rather by the capitalists, by the owners of the means of production. In this sense, we estrange ourselves from one another by participating in the capitalist mode of production because we produce stuff that we ourselves will never use, but rather we produce things that other people are going to use. For Marx, communism, again, was, and I quote, the positive transcendence of private property as human self-estrangement. When you abolish private property, you abolish this process by which we alienate ourselves from the fruits of our labor and thereby alienate ourselves from one another. And naturally, that sounds great. Again, in my Econ 323 class, we talked about Mises's article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, on Tuesday. And I played John Lennon's Imagine for everybody. And then so you listen to Imagine, and John Lennon sings Imagine. Imagine no possessions. Imagine there are no countries. Imagine no religion. Imagine this, imagine that, imagine the other thing. And, you know, you may say that I'm a dreamer. I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world can live as one. And indeed, that sounds so very, very profound. But when we step back a bit and we think about how exactly this world that John Lennon might imagine, or more fundamentally, this world that Marx says we're tending toward, we realize that it's not exactly the paradise that people think that it's going to be. Because we tried to implement this, and what we got were death camps, gulags, and the Berlin Wall. The attempts to implement the socialist vision in the 20th century were shocking. They were absolutely, positively monstrous. We took, and indeed, this is one of the cruel ironies of socialism, is here's this idea that maybe we can go and we can create the good society. We can create a just society. We can create a better world for ourselves, a better world for our children, a better world for our parents, a better world for all of humanity. And what we did is we combined the worst elements of the state with sheer godlessness, with the technological advances of the Industrial Revolution to create killing machines unlike anything the world had ever seen. The body count from states and wars in the 20th century is on the order of 260 million people. I believe at last count, the people who died in Stalin's gulags were over 20 million. Over 70 million Chinese died at the hands of Mao. Indeed, once Germany was separated after World War II into capitalist West Germany and communist East Germany, it wasn't really that long before the Social Democrats, the alleged lovers of humanity, had built the Berlin Wall and were shooting people who were trying to flee East Berlin. I want to think first of all about what the different kinds of socialism are, and then also what exactly produced these kinds and these types of socialism. So, Hoppe discusses a couple of different types of socialism. First, he talks about Russian-style socialism or Russian-style communism. So you have the Bolshevik Revolution, and as part of the Bolshevik Revolution, they decide that what they're going to do is they're going to basically completely destroy the architecture of bourgeois capitalist society. They're going to get rid of money, they're going to completely socialize the means of production, and they're going to get rid of market exchange. If you know the history of this, you know that this was an absolute disaster. This was a pure humanitarian disaster that killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but this alleged move toward a better world and toward a better humanity was in fact an absolute slaughter. In 1921, the Russians inaugurated the new economic policy, where they basically restored at least some of the institutions of the market economy, and this allowed for at least some additional production and allowed for at least some recovery and stemmed some of the bleeding or staunched some of the bleeding, literal and figurative, that was going on as a result of the Russian Revolution. But over time they decided to ditch that again too and go back again toward central planning. The implications, again, of Soviet central planning were several. You had direct and complete inefficiency. It was impossible for them to decide what to produce, how to produce it, where to produce it, and so on and so forth. They brought in a lot of American intellectuals. They brought in a lot of American companies to build some of their industrial installations. But the best they could do was imitate the production processes that were going on in the Western world and used the prices that were being set on Western and world markets to engage in some sort of quasi-economic calculation that really didn't do a whole lot. The Soviet production structure was horrific. The consumer goods that were produced were, in many cases, absolutely unusable. The statistics of production in the Soviet Union were often outright lies. And the methods of production were indeed more anarchic, well, let's not even say anarchic, but they were more chaotic, perhaps ironically, than the alleged anarchy of production that they'd been designed and implemented in order to replace. So you have this idea that by socializing the means of production, we're going to get all of these wonderful outcomes. We're going to get material superabundance. We're going to get universal brotherhood. We're going to eliminate the anarchy of production and replace it with very, very careful, very, very rational, very well thought out central planning. As we learned, this was absolutely positively not the case. So let's think first of all about the planning problems that confronted the Soviets. And then second of all, let's think a little bit about the incentives that confronted the Soviets. So the planning problems were obvious. Again, as Mises pointed out, when we have no private ownership of the means of production, rational economic calculation is impossible. Again, granted, the Soviets were able to observe world market prices, and they were able to enter these prices into systems of equations that might give them at least some idea of maybe possibly how to produce certain things. But even that, even beyond that, the incentives were all wrong. No one had the requisite knowledge and no one had the requisite incentives to produce real output that actually accomplished anything or that actually really satisfied consumer wants. They were paid perhaps, or they were compensated perhaps, on the basis of tons of steel, or on the basis of number of cars, where what exactly was being produced was very, very difficult to define. And so keep that in mind. What's being produced is difficult to define, and indeed impossible to define in the absence of private property and free exchange. We'll talk about that again here in just a few minutes. Socialism combined a gigantic knowledge problem and a gigantic calculation problem with a total absence of economic incentives. The knowledge problem took two forms. First, no one knew what to produce, how to produce it. This was an implication of Mises. Second, as Hayek pointed out in his 1945 article, knowledge, and specifically local knowledge, is essential to rational economic calculation. No one knew on the ground what people wanted, where they wanted it, when they wanted it, how they wanted it. To use Hayek's phrase, the particular circumstances of time and place could only be known by private individual actors and not by any kind of central planner who is trying to develop a comprehensive plan for the entire society in the absence of private property, free markets, and voluntary exchange. So let's think about the radical break for a second. We'll talk about democratic socialism in a second and conservative socialism in a second. But let's think about the break that occurred as Mises and Hayek did their writing on economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth. In 1908, Enrico Baron published an article in which he fiddled around a little bit with systems of equations and said, okay, yeah, we can solve this problem. If we reduce the problem of economic calculation to constrained optimization, then it's obvious that we can solve this using a certain system of equations, but this is probably going to be pretty silly as a method of actually trying to calculate in a socialist economy. Mises and Hayek, again, of course, completely blew this up. The argument for a while was, well, okay, socialism might be great in theory. Socialism might work in theory. Socialism might be a moral and ethical ideal because we're sharing and we have no possessions and we all live as one, so on and so forth. But as some people put it, the big question under socialism was, who takes out the garbage? No one really knew how to solve this. And indeed, the ultimate evasion that was made by the socialists themselves was to say that, well, come the revolution, socialism will fundamentally alter and fundamentally change human nature. People will want to take out the garbage. They will labor always and everywhere on behalf of the society, not based on any individual interest, not based on any private interest, not based on any selfish motives, but solely on the basis of their desire to make their society as glorious and wealthy and as rich as they could. So there are a couple of solutions to these problems. First, the problem of who will take out the trash under socialism was solved by hypothesis, because socialism would be the transcendence of human self, of private property as human self estrangement. And also it would be the transcendence of selfishness and self-interest as a motive for any kind of human behavior. Indeed, I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, sort of a joke I've heard about the great rabble rousers for socialism saying, "Come the revolution, the rivers will flow with milk and honey." And one of the comrades raises his hand and says, "Well, what if I don't like milk and honey?" And the evangelist for communism says, "Oh, well, comrade, come the revolution, you will like milk and honey." So you have this hypothesized change in human nature that ultimately did not come about. So the incentive problem is not and was not solved. And Mises himself said he dispensed with the incentive problem and said, if we assume that this is not going to be a constraint, we still cannot get rational economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth. So problems of incentives and problems of information plagued the Soviet central planners of the first part of the 20th century, and they led to the kind of misery that you read about in textbooks, or if you've read the Black Book of Communism, or if you've read any of these accounts of Stalin's purges, or any of these accounts of the absolute horror that occurred in the communist world. And we get all of this as a result, in large part, of these alleged claims that, hey, you know, we're going to create a great society, we're going to create a beautiful new world, and lo and behold, what we did was create what was as close to hell on earth as we've probably gotten. Hoppe discusses two other kinds of socialism. He talks about social democracy. So he talks about social democratic socialism. And this is heavily redistributive, and there can still be private property. So this is not, in a sense, pure socialism. So I think that what Hoppe is critiquing is a type of interventionism. And the key points Hoppe raises about social democratic socialism have to do with the fact that, yes, people might still be able to own private property in a nominal sense, but they don't own all of the attributes of their private property, and they're not allowed to earn income from their private property. The fact that they don't own all of the attributes of their private property, and the fact that they're not allowed to earn income from all attributes of their private property, means that at least some of the attributes of this private property have, in fact, been socialized. And what this is going to do is this is, first of all, going to eliminate and destroy information. People are not going to know how to calculate with respect to the margins of physical goods, services, concepts, private property that they don't actually own. And then second, they're going to have diminished incentives. Their incentives are not going to be to maximize the value of whatever's entrusted to their care, or to maximize the value of whatever they happen to own, but to maximize their own personal satisfaction. So if you own only some of the attributes of a particular good or service, like say yourself, given that we just got through tax season, then you're going to have diminished incentives to maximize the value of your assets. And you're going to have diminished incentives to engage in ultimately productive activity. This is where socialism and interventionism are fundamentally corrosive of any kind of well-functioning and peaceful social order. And Hoppe draws this out over the course of his chapters on different types of socialism. Where he says that he basically says we have these gigantic changes in incentives. So let's move away from the knowledge problem for just a second and focus solely on incentives under interventionism. When we live in an interventionist society, people have diminished incentives to produce an exchange, because whatever they produce is probably, part of it's going to be extracted from them, either via regulatory mechanisms whereby the state appropriates some of the specific valuable attributes of goods and services, or via the tax system, whereby the state expropriates some of the fruits of our labor. So people are going to have diminished incentives to maintain and increase the value of the resources at their disposal. Second, people are going to have incentives to move away from the margins that are taxed and toward the margins that are not taxed. So for example, if people are taxed for laboring, they're going to have a diminished incentive to labor and an increased incentive relative to laboring to engage in leisure. So people are going to say, okay, yeah, forget this. At a marginal tax rate of 40% or 50% or 60%. And indeed, if we bring back the Beatles here, their song, The Tax Man, I believe they're talking about a 98% marginal tax rate in Britain. 98 for me, 2 for you, or 98 for you, 2 for me, whatever the lyric itself is. And indeed, it's somewhat ironic that John Lennon would sing, would be part of that song, and then would later sing Imagine. People are going to have diminished incentives to engage in productive labors as opposed to engaging in leisure. Also, if we're able to create rents, so this is a third point about how people's incentives change. If we're able to create economic rents, so in other words, if we're able to create via the legislative system returns on activities in excess of our opportunity costs, or in other words, just basically put a giant pile of goodies out on the table and say, hey, come and get it, then we're going to see people investing resources, not, again, not in producing valuable goods and services, but in finding ways to get their hands on the goodies. So people are going to invest not only in non-productive types of labor, not only in non-productive skills, and not only in non-productive relationships, we're going to see them invest in destructive activities, destructive skills, and destructive social relationships. Parenthetically, if anyone is a graduate student who happens to be looking for a thesis, okay, ah, great. So first of all, thank you to Stephen Davis. Here's one for you, 19 for me. Okay, great. Go ahead. So I appreciate that. I'm not the aficionado of the Beatles that I would like to be. Are there any graduate students in the class or anybody who's looking for a project? I think something that would be very, very interesting would be to try to develop the Austrian perspective on social capital and how people invest in pathological relationships. Sort of like Ayn Rand's villains, the creation of an aristocracy at pull, when you have interventionism and when you have people with incentives to expropriate and redistribute rather than produce and exchange. So this is kind of interesting. When we think about socialism, a lot of times we grant people the moral high ground, in a sense. We talk about socialists perhaps being idealists or saying, well, they mean well, or, you know, this might work in theory, or this is an ethical ideal toward which we should strive. And people have been absolutely shocked that socialism has eventuated, or that socialism has degenerated into tyranny, and indeed degenerated into tyranny very, very quickly. So we want to know why exactly this is. Like I said a minute ago, I mean, this is something that is absolute. I think is a bit of a crime. So I'm going to pause for just a second to think a little bit about how little people actually know about the communist experience in the 20th century. I remember, you know, when I was growing up, we had a we knew, of course, about the absolutely inexcusable and horrific slaughter that took place during the Holocaust. At the hands of the Germans, at the hands of the Nazis. And we learned about slavery, and we learned about this giant litany of unambiguous crimes against humanity. And to be perfectly clear, I don't want to diminish any of that at all. The slave trade was barbaric. I mean, it was among the sort of the true pinnacles of human barbarism. What the Nazis did, I understand to a degree why that is the sort of generic standard for evil. So I don't want to diminish that. But I remember learning relatively little about human rights abuses under communism. And I remember learning relatively little about people who died at the hands of Stalin, or at the hands of Mao, or at the hands of Che Guevara, or at the hands of Pol Pot, or at the hands of any of a number of other brutal, brutal dictators, or brutal and I would argue, unambiguously evil people that dwarfed what might have been done by Hitler in Europe. Again, not to diminish the evils of the Nazi regime, but what we have here is sort of two branches of the same tree. Indeed, I think it was, I remember reading in Thomas Sowell's most recent book, Intellectuals in Society, in which I think he attributes this to W.E.B. Du Bois. I would encourage you to read his book. It's great. Check this out. One of these great intellectuals of the early 20th century said that basically German fascism and Russian communism were the two full flowerings of Marxism in the early 20th century. I don't understand why we tend to downplay the crimes against humanity that took place under communism and under the tyranny of the communists. And furthermore, I'm also not really sure why we're shocked. So let's think a little bit about different theories of the emergence of socialist tyranny. So you have here on the slide, in the upper, what is my upper left-hand corner, is Lord Acton. You probably, if you've ever heard the expression, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, that's from Lord Acton. Acton is a gentleman for whom the Acton Institute in Michigan, in the United States, and then around the world, is named, and he's sort of a great theorist of liberty. And the Acton explanation for communist tyranny would be, well, okay, maybe you had idealists and you had solid moral people starting out, but they were corrupted by power. They were corrupted by what communism had to offer. Hayek's argument for communist tyranny was that basically it's to put it in sort of a to use sort of a crude illustration. I remember hearing someone refer to what they called the septic tank theory of politics, which is the big chunks float to the top. And so this is effectively Hayek's argument for how and why socialism degenerated into tyranny and did so quickly. Perhaps idealists created this set of institutions, but then these were co-opted by evil people who floated to the top, so to speak, and took over and manifested themselves in this absolute great and horrific and horrible evil that took place in the 20th century. One of the advanced readings that I offered here is Eugen von Richter's Pictures of the Socialist Future, reviewed by, which contains an introduction by Brian Kaplan, who is one of my favorite economists. And he wrote the introduction for Pictures of the Socialist Future. And Kaplan's argument, borrowing from Richter, is that socialism was born bad to begin with. It wasn't just that the people who were involving themselves in these socialist revolutions were idealists. It's that their ideal was totalitarianism, and there I'm paraphrasing Kaplan to a degree. It was the creation of these types of murderous institutions that was what the socialists were ultimately going for. And again, I would encourage all of you to, so you can either download Pictures of the Socialistic Future, because it's available for $0 on Mises.org, or buy it and put it on your nightstand. It's amazing just how utterly prescient the book is, how before any of the socialist revolutions of the 20th century even took place, Richter basically nails exactly what socialism is ultimately going to generate. I have my copy right here. I reviewed it for Forbes. And again, I encourage you to take a look at it, because the development of these institutions, the intellectual history of the development of these institutions, I think these are both open research questions that we don't fully understand quite as well as we would like to. And I'd like to see a little bit more inquiry in that respect. So social democratic socialism, and indeed conservative socialism, were types of socialism whereby certain aspects of the production process or certain aspects of human life were owned and operated and controlled by some sort of central planning board, rather than the individuals themselves who actually would be making the on-the-ground decisions in the case of a private ownership of the means of production. In pretty much all of these cases, we create incredibly perverse incentives for people, and we destroy the knowledge and the information that would be needed in order to engage in rational economic calculation. As a result, we get the sorts of horrors that we saw in the 20th century. These are the fundamental problems of socialism. The first is incentives. The second is calculation. So when we think about what we would like in an economic system, let's go back to Hoppe's question from the first class. Hoppe talks about the creation of an economic order that basically solves the problem of poverty, that creates economic growth, and that is ultimately and fundamentally just. We destroy literally the information and the institutions that make not just economic growth and not just civilization, but as Salerno argues in his postscript to Mises's Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, thought itself almost is destroyed when we abrogate private ownership of the means of production. So where did all this come from? The first of the Austrian economists was Karl Menger, who wrote and published, I believe it was I forget exactly when he published Principles of Economics. But again, I remember in reading this thinking about how subjective value, marginal value, and the role of the entrepreneur three of what I think are the most important ideas in all of economics, and indeed all of social science, are wrapped up in Menger. When we read Menger, we begin to see the beginnings of the body of theory that would be developed by Mises, that would be further developed by Hayek, and that a lot of people working in the Austrian tradition are sort of currently hammering away at right now. Part of the fundamental revolution that Menger started was to overturn where the classical economists began. They started with division of labor, they started with production, and they started with a labor theory of value. Indeed, I've argued before that once you get rid of the labor theory of value, once you get rid of Marx's complete misunderstanding of production, it's not at all clear to me that there's anything that even that remains in Marx that that can be salvaged or that could be that could even be thought of as a meaningful or useful contribution to social theory. A lot of the critique of Marx originates in Menger, in part because Menger, instead of going from production to output and analyzing output in terms of the value created in the production process, Menger goes from the existence of goods or the necessity of goods backward to the valuation of factors of production. So note here that we see Mises' critical insight about the necessity of private ownership of the means of production for rational economic calculation. This begins in Menger. So we're going to discuss a couple of things in Menger. First, theory of goods and what that implies. Second, we're going to discuss what Menger has to say about the role of the entrepreneur. And then we'll talk about knowledge and means. And then that'll wrap it up. Okay. So Menger began with a discussion of goods. Instead of talking about production and then somehow goods happen, Menger talked about goods being the reason why production takes place and the fundamental source of value. Goods have four characteristics, according to Menger. And the quotes here are from Robert Eklund and Robert Hebert's book on called A History of Economic Theory and Method. They discuss Menger's view of goods as follows. Something must fulfill a human need. So you have to have some want, and you have to have something that will fulfill that want. So for example, I am thirsty, I drink tea. It must have properties that would establish a causal connection between it and the satisfaction of the need. So for example, again, I'm thirsty, I have tea. Tea has certain properties. It's comprised of water and tea floating in the water that that will hydrate me, and it tastes good and does all sorts of other wonderful stuff. It has properties that will establish a causal connection between the consumption of the tea and the satisfaction of the need. I have to recognize the causal connection between the consumption of the tea and the satisfaction of the need. So I have to realize, okay, yes, in fact, there is enough that this will satisfy my thirst. And then finally, there must be command of the thing sufficient to direct it to the satisfaction of the need. So one atom of water, good Lord, water's not an atom. One molecule of water is not going to do a whole lot for me. I need to have enough to form a unit or a meaningful unit, a service unit, to borrow Rothbard's phrase, that I can then direct to the satisfaction of the need. So let's see. So let's do an experiment. Okay, the thing must fulfill a human need. Okay, I'm now satisfied, at least for the short term. Must have properties that would establish a causal connection between it and the satisfaction of the need. All right. It tastes great. This is Tazo Zen tea, which is great. It's what I usually get when I go. It's what I try to get when I go to Starbucks now because I'm trying to drink less coffee. It's that combined with water. There must be a recognition of this causal connection. Okay, so I recognize that this will satisfy my needs. There must be command of the thing sufficient to direct it to the satisfaction of the need. At least in the very short run, there was enough left in the cup to satisfy the need that I had, which was to avoid being thirsty for the next several minutes. So we'll try this again. Okay. All right. So that experiment worked worked just as well. All right. Wonderful. So who says that economics can't be an experimental or empirical science? All right. So What Menger has to offer, it manifests itself through Mises and through Hayek, where what is fundamentally valuable is the consumable output that is produced, the consumable and investable output, the final output that is produced, and not the process itself. It is the consumable output that gives value to everything along the structure of production. So what I have here is a slide that I got from Roger Garrison. I hope you're familiar with Professor Garrison. You should look up his lecture on the Austrian theory of the business cycle, which my Econ 100 students should be watching for class a week from today. And he's probably the person from whom I have learned the most about macroeconomics in my life. Even though I myself went to Alabama, and the only times that I've gotten to know Professor Garrison have been primarily through Mises Institute events. We start with consumable output and work our way backward, where it's the fact that I want to drink the tea, and I'm willing to pay a certain amount of money for this cup of tea, that gives value to the labor of the retailers and all of the resources that go into the retailing of the tea. That gives value to the lid, that gives value to the cup, that gives value to the water, that gives value to the tea, that gives value to the string and the tag, and so on and so forth. The value of the tea is imputed backward through the structure of production, and everything that is involved in the production process gets its value not from the amount of labor that it embodies or something like that, but from the fact that it can be used to produce final goods and services that people are willing to pay for. Okay. So the fact that that was valuable to me is what gives the tea value. It's what gives the plastic value. It's what gives the styrofoam value. It's what gives the petroleum from which the plastic and the styrofoam were made value. And it's what gives the labor of my soon-to-be brother-in-law, who is a petroleum engineer in Houston, so it gives his labor value. It's the fact that I am willing to consume this. I'm willing to pay for it. Therefore, everything involved in the production process is valuable. Okay. Now, let's talk about entrepreneurs just a little bit, because this is another of Menger's fundamental insights, and something that Mises and Hayek will build on through their work in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. So, when we think about classical theories of income determination and classical theories of income distribution, national income formerly, the way that we would think about it, or the way that David Ricardo thought about it, the way that Karl Marx thought about it, factor incomes would flow to wages for labor, rents for the owners of natural resources, and profits for the owners of capital. According to Ricardo, all of the income would accrue to the owners of natural resources. According to Marx, all of the income would accrue to the owners of capital. In history, what we realize is that almost all of the income has accrued not just to labor, but specifically to unskilled labor, in large part as a result of the actions of entrepreneurs, who earn a fourth factor, or a fourth category of factor income, which is profit. And profit is a return to entrepreneurship. It's a return to good judgment, and it's essential to a well-functioning economy. The problem with socialism is that since the means of production are commonly owned, there is no entrepreneur, there is no residual claimant, there's no place where the buck stops, and no one, except for all of us, who will bear the consequences of bad decisions. So Menger offers four claims about what entrepreneurs do. Excuse me, goodness. So what does an entrepreneur do, and how and why is that essential? Entrepreneurs gather information about what people might want to do. Hey, you know what? Maybe people would like to link up with one another on computers. Maybe they'd like to be able to share pictures of their kids, pictures of their families, status updates, what I had for lunch, articles that they read, insights, all sorts of stuff. Maybe they'd like to do that. So gather information. They calculate on the basis of appraisement of first factors of production, the prices of which are going to be determined in competitive marketplaces, and second, their expectations about the revenue that a production process can generate. So in the case of Facebook, You have servers, entrepreneurial energy, programmer talents, and all sorts of other things that are going to go into the cost side of it. And then the revenue side of it will be, what are people going to be what are firms going to be willing to pay for the information that is produced by Facebook? And from the fact that Facebook is effectively selling this networking service to people like you and me in exchange for insight into our private lives and insight into our sort of deepest, darkest thoughts. The phrase that jumped out at me in Menger here is act of will. Entrepreneurship. An entrepreneur, it is said, is someone with a comparative advantage in judgment. And that judgment is going to manifest itself in an act of will, whereby the entrepreneurs will assign, first of all, they'll go out and they will either purchase or hire factors of production. Then they will assign those goods to a production process. And it is their act of will that makes production take place. Finally, what entrepreneurs do is they supervise the production process. Then they recalculate, they reassess, and they reappraise as new information reveals itself. This, I think, is where Hayek really shines in this whole discussion. Is entrepreneurs are those who have a comparative advantage in the assembly of information about the particular circumstances of time and place, as they're also residual claimants to the income that is generated by a production process. They also have the incentive to try as hard as they can to make the right choices. So, why does capitalism work? Why do free markets work? We have entrepreneurs. We have private ownership of the means of production that can be hired and purchased by entrepreneurs who can then use those to engage in production processes from which they hope to earn profits. Those profits are the signals that tell them whether they're using resources wisely or using resources unwisely. Why are we so rich, Nathan? As we'll discuss next week and in our final lecture, this is part and parcel of Deidre McCluskey's ongoing research project on what she calls the bourgeois era. Her first book was called Bourgeois Virtues, Ethics for an Age of Commerce. The second book in this series is called Bourgeois Dignity, Why Economics Can't Explain the Modern World. And McCluskey goes through and basically knocks out all of the materialist hypotheses for why we're so wealthy. It wasn't trade, even though trade helped. It wasn't slavery, even though slavery made some people very wealthy and it made a lot of people very, very poor. It wasn't primitive accumulation. It wasn't exploitation. It wasn't colonialism. It wasn't coal. It wasn't natural resources. It was not. This whole list of things that don't explain it. McCluskey identifies a gigantic residual and claims that what that residual embodies is a change in the cultural rhetoric. It was when entrepreneurship and innovation became dignified, became something that was not to be either dismissed as unimportant or indeed criticized as being in some way immoral or ignoble. It was the fact that this entered the cultural discourse that helped to create the 16-fold increase in standards of living, conservatively measured, that we've seen in the Western world, in countries like the US, Great Britain, and a lot of countries in Europe. It is the fact that we live in a world in which Mark Zuckerberg can be on the cover of Time magazine as the man of the year, rather than some politician, that has helped to generate the massive amount of wealth that we see around us. This helped to create a world in which some of you are watching from Canada, some of you are watching from the Czech Republic, and some of you are watching, I know that Danny Sanchez is administering this from Taiwan, and I'm doing this from an office in Memphis. It's the fact that entrepreneurs are now dignified, or at least are now respected by the culture, that has helped to produce this wonderful world in which we live. Do we have a very long way to go? Yes, we do. I mean, obviously the world's not perfect. There are a lot of poor people who need a lot of help, but at the very least, this has been a pretty nice start. Hayek identifies the knowledge problem, and a lot of people who work in the Hayekian tradition say that this is the essential critique, or one of the essential critiques of interventionism, is it always runs into the how do you know question entrepreneurs acting on a private market are going to get profit and loss signals that will tell them whether they're choosing wisely or choosing poorly. Government officials and bureaucrats, they get no such signals. Indeed, the signals that they get are budgets and votes. And these are, as a lot of people have shown, pathological signals, in a sense. Because what it takes to get elected is not necessarily what it takes to make a society prosperous. As we see time and time and time and time again, virtually every time we have an election, we're going to see someone saying something that just makes no economic sense whatsoever. James Buchanan has who won the Nobel Prize in 1986 for his work in public choice, has done a lot of very interesting work in the Austrian Hayekian Nicessian tradition. In particular, his book Cost and Choice, which I would encourage you to look up. It's another book that you can get the whole thing free online. This is from the Library of Economics and Liberty. One of the fundamental problems that any intervention, I think, runs into is the process of defining exactly what we're talking about. Buchanan writes about order defined in the process of its emergence. And when we talk about means of production, I honestly don't see how exactly we can even define what means of production are, how we can even define resources in the absence of the exchange process, in the absence of voluntary interaction. So when we talk about socializing the means of production, I think the fundamental implication of that is not just to destroy information, not just to destroy incentives, and not just to revert to primitivism, but also literally to destroy the stuff of thought. Because when the means of production are not privately owned, when they're collectively owned, when everybody owns it, there's no social process by which we can even define what we're talking about. And that, I think, is an essential and fundamental criticism of the socialist program. So with that, I think we have about 25 minutes for questions. If anybody has any, I would be more than happy to answer. Again, the lecture itself will be online. I'm going to do what I can to make up some quizzes. The final exam, when all said and done, I'm probably just going to make that 100 questions or something like that, 1 point each. I'll let you know about grading when push comes to shove. I've read at least some of your essays that people sent in, summarizing the first two lectures. I think they've been very, very good. What I would encourage you to do is to try to find outlets for these. If you have a blog of your own, write up there. Try to find an op-ed. If you have a local newspaper, generally these are looking for good content. If you write for a campus newspaper, I know from my own time writing for the Crimson White at the University of Alabama, the quality of commentary and journalism in college newspapers is abysmal. So if there's any sense in which that can be improved, then I would encourage you to go forth and please do it. So, okay. All right, so what is the difference, if any, between Hayek's knowledge problem and Mises' calculation problem? Okay, here there's a technical debate in the professional literature where there's some Austrians who disavow Hayek as having contributed much to the debate over socialist calculation. As I read Hayek, Hayek is saying that even if socialist calculation were possible in the absence of private ownership of the means of production, the economic problem becomes of a very, very different kind, which is that it becomes a problem of assembling the dispersed bits of knowledge throughout a society, and then finding some way to employ those for purposes of producing, and that just can't be done without prices. So Mises says, economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth is impossible. Even if we know all of the technology, all of the technological possibilities, even if we have a complete inventory of natural resources, even if we know exactly what we should produce, the fact of the matter is when we separate consumers' goods from producers' goods, there's no process by which we can price the factors of production and by which we can then engage in rational economic calculation. Hayek, some people have interpreted Hayek as saying, okay, if we have all of the technology, or if we know everything about the technology, if we have a complete inventory of resources, and if we have complete knowledge about consumers' preferences, then we can calculate. The problem is just that that's going to be an unworkable solution in a world of dispersed knowledge. My reading of Hayek, and this is expressed, a student and I actually have a paper forthcoming in a journal called Economic Affairs, in which we discussed this just a little bit. I'm more sympathetic to the Hayekian argument here, or the Hayekian argument as an extension of Mises, because I read Hayek as saying, let's assume that Mises is wrong. So just even though he's not, let's assume that Mises is wrong. Even if Mises is wrong, the economic problem becomes far, far, far more complex, because it becomes a matter then of finding some way to assemble and assimilate all of this dispersed knowledge about the particular circumstances of time and place that cannot be known by an individual mind. So in a nutshell, that's my understanding of the differences between the Hayekian knowledge problem and Mises' calculation problem. If you look at Salerno's postscript to Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, he discusses this debate just a little bit. Murray Rothbard has a couple of essays in The Logic of Action 1, I believe, and I don't know if Logic of Action is downloadable. I would check. You might be able to download it from Mises.org. Otherwise, you can get it from Edward Elgar for, $60 a volume. I mean, their stuff is generally pretty expensive. In which he discusses this in some detail too. Is a lot of that stuff in Economic Controversies. That depends. Okay. All right. Excellent. Okay, Stephen. Thank you very, very much. Okay. So good. PDF and EPUB on Mises.org. That is wonderful. I generally am going to in terms of the very, very technical details about Mises and Hayek. I'm going to defer in this case to those who have published more than I have on it, particularly Joseph Salerno, who has a lot of good work on this, and Steve Horowitz as well. Okay, so several of the Scandinavian countries, such as Sweden and Finland, are examples of democratic socialism with high tax rates. If they appear to have, Okay, hold on. Sorry, I'm losing the question here. People are asking. Okay, so what about Scandinavia? Scandinavian countries such as Sweden and Finland as examples of democratic socialism with high tax rates, yet they appear to have high standards of living. How can this be? Okay, so first of all, a lot of these countries were very, very rich before they went toward social democracy. Sweden, for example, is still today one of the richest countries in the world, but it was near the top in the 1960s and whatnot before they went toward very heavy progressive taxation and before they went toward a gigantic welfare state. So there's a sense in which these countries are consuming their capital and they're sort of living off of the glories of the past. One thing that European welfare states do is they have a much more efficient tax structure than we have in the United States. So for example, in the United States, we tax capital accumulation and we subsidize consumption, which is pretty much the opposite of what you want to do to create economic growth. As I understand European tax systems, they are able to, basically, they subsidize via the tax system, they subsidize saving and capital accumulation, and they tax consumption. So they have tax policy that is very heavily weighted toward economic growth, and we have a tax system that is sort of antithetical to economic growth. Peter Lindert's 2004 book Growing Public is a book that I would encourage you to look at. Basically, he says, why is it that it looks like in terms of growth rates, European welfare states appear to be a free lunch? Well, that's a big part of his argument. Also, thinking about the Scandinavian countries, Peter Klein is a name that some of you might know, and we spoke at a conference in Copenhagen, and indeed, the video that you're going to watch either for next week or the week after, when I talk about In Defense of Capitalism, that's from that very conference. We spoke in Copenhagen, and people hold up Denmark Sweden, etc., as these shining examples of welfare states. First of all, the populations are ethnically homogeneous. So one of the things that appears in the literature on these kinds of things is that ethnically homogeneous countries are able to have big welfare states, while ethnically diverse countries like the U.S. are not. That's probably deeply rooted in evolutionary psychology, where a lot of people in the U.S. say, "Well, okay, I don't want money to be taken from me and given to them." In Denmark, Sweden, etc., countries that are relatively ethnically homogeneous, it's like, okay, we're all Danes here, or we're all Swedes here, therefore we're participating in. No one's trying to game the system because we're all Swedes and Swedes are morally superior to everybody else or something like that. Also, the populations of these countries are extremely low. So when I was in Denmark, I looked at the population. The population of Denmark is something like 5 million people, which is like by several million fewer people than live in metropolitan New York City. So you're dealing with extremely small populations. And I think one of the mistakes that the left makes is to extrapolate from these very small ethnically homogeneous populations to a country like the United States with 300 million plus people and say, oh, look, it works in Denmark. Can it not work here? So long story short, they have a tax system that encourages economic growth, or at least it doesn't discourage it as much as ours does. And they were also extremely rich several decades ago. So they have high standards of living because they inherited those standards of living from earlier generations. And part of the glories of Google is you can check me on this. As I understand it, if Sweden were an American state, it would be the poorest state in the Union. Sweden is, on a per capita income basis, poorer than Mississippi. So they have high standards of living, and they have all sorts of great and wonderful stuff, but a bit of perspective is probably in order here. Okay, so Hoppe's idea of conservative socialism difficult to visualize. Some concrete example countries or governments of conservative socialism. Is Hoppe thinking of populist authoritarian regimes in Latin America like Peron? Okay, so I avoided conservative socialism a little bit because it's not clear necessarily what exactly people mean when they talk about conservative. So for example, Hayek has this classic essay called "I Am Not a Conservative" or "Why I'm Not a Conservative." Excuse me, Buchanan has a book called Why I Too Am Not a Conservative. Someday I want to write an article or an essay or a book called Why I, like Hayek and Buchanan, am also not a conservative. In the case of Hayek, however, he's talking about conservative. He's using conservative primarily in the European sense. And there's a degree to which I read a little bit of that into Hoppe. So I want to make sure that I'm not misreading. But when I think of conservative, I think of a sort of veneration for the past, veneration for old institutions, precisely because they're old, or veneration for the greatness of our former civilization, or something to that effect. So what's happening, I think, when we have a conservative socialist regime, is we may not be socializing the means of production, but we're socializing aspects of the means of social change. So for example, I talked about, so we'll just kind of click back a slide here. We talked about entrepreneurs and dignity. The aversion to entrepreneurship and the absence of dignity for entrepreneurs was fundamentally conservative. It was because people liked things the way they were. And well, not just all people, but the elites liked things the way they were. And in a sense, they socialized some aspects of the means of cultural production. By arrogating to themselves the right to tell people you can or cannot pursue this or that innovation. So when Hoppe's talking about conservative socialism, I think that's primarily what he's talking about. Now, if we want to talk about conservative socialism in the United States, we have a very large degree to which we have socialized the means of protection. So, for example, a lot of conservatives talk a very, very big game. A lot of conservatives in the United States talk a big game about free markets and liberty, but if anything, they want to increase the amount of money that we spend on war. So that so as the economist David Henderson has pointed out, war is a government program. And war is, the U.S. military is fundamentally a gigantic socialist enterprise. So that might be a degree to which there's a type of conservative socialism in the United States. A lot of conservatives are not social libertarians. For example, they're enthusiastic about using the state to prevent other people from making private choices with which they disagree. So, for example, being homosexuals. Maybe not smoking. People, conservatives are probably all about the right to smoke. So homosexuality, drug use, pornography, violent video games, romance novels, sort of this gigantic list of things that a lot of cultural conservatives think that the state has not just the right or the prerogative, but the duty to control. So I think that's probably what Hoppe is getting at when he talks about conservative socialism. See, populist authoritarian regimes like Perón, I'd like to dig into that a little bit. I think that would be a great paper topic. Robert Lawson and I have an article on human rights abuses and economic liberalization, in which we deal to a very small extent with Latin American countries. But I think that's something that, again, if there are students who are looking for paper topics, or people looking for things to write columns about, I think something like that would be worth looking into. Okay, so is there a relationship between our quasi-socialism in the public sector and their inflated out-of-market benefit programs, especially unfunded pension liabilities? I think yes, because there are a lot of things. Let me think about this for just a second, because I want to couch this in terms of Hoppe. The answer to your question is yes. So Hoppe talks about, I forget the page number specifically. Okay, that's a great question about the tax deduction for mortgage interest. We'll talk about that here in just a second. Hoppe talks specifically about how statism changes people's incentives, and it eliminates incentives for people to engage in productive activity and gives them incentives to engage in more redistributive activity. So the fact that we've socialized so much stuff, so for example, we have, and there's a degree to which this is really kind of depressing when you think about how much socialism we have in the United States. Someone asked me one time, have you ever lived in a socialist country? And I said, yes, the United States. I mean, being to a degree that's sort of tongue-in-cheek, because we have a stock market and we have certain types of freedom, but there's a lot of stuff that's provided via socialist institutions. Education, for example, is very heavily socialized, almost totally socialized. Protection of private property is socialized via police departments, fire departments, and things like that. Via the military, national defense is socialized. An increasing share of healthcare is socialized. Safety is workplace safety is socialized. There are all of these different socialist institutions that are not in any way, shape, or form bound by, constrained by, or responsive to the profit and loss incentives that would emerge on the private market. Given that, if people want to increase their real incomes, what they're going to do is respond to the incentives in place, such as, for example, trying to get nicer, juicier, healthier pensions, or trying to get these and I quote the question, inflated out-of-market benefit programs, especially unfunded pension liabilities. So people have political incentives rather than market incentives to go out and get goodies. And since states are responsive to political incentives rather than market incentives, they have then an incentive to spend uncontrollably, irresponsibly, and unsustainably. I have an article about this that was on Forbes.com a couple of weeks ago during these protests that were going on in Wisconsin. A lot of people have said, well, oh, look, you know, it turns out the public employees are underpaid relative to their education and things like that. There are some measurement issues there, but one thing that is often not accounted for is the fact that it is very, very difficult to fire a public employee, and a lot of people who work for governments don't quit their jobs. I am willing to accept a lower salary than I probably otherwise would because I get a great deal of job satisfaction and job security from being a college professor. I'm up for tenure next year, and that basically means if I'm granted tenure, I can more or less do whatever I want, sort of within the bounds of certain professional ethics, and not be fired for it. It's effectively lifetime employment. What that means is that I'm then going to accept I'm going to accept lower wages as a result, because I participate somewhat in a competitive market, at least on the supply side. But when you're dealing with different branches of different types of public employee, they get these gigantic pensions, they get cushy jobs with a very low probability of being dismissed or fired. And in the case of things like college professors, a great deal of job satisfaction. I tell people I have the best job in the world because my job is to do basically exactly this: talk about things I find interesting, read about things I find interesting, and write about things I find interesting. Okay. Conservatives' reluctance to eliminate the tax deduction for mortgage interest as an example of conservative socialism. Okay, so that raises an interesting point, because I'm generally in favor of anything that reduces people's taxes, but the mortgage interest deduction is unbelievably distortionary. It causes people to overconsume housing. So you can run down the list of ways in which the mortgage interest deduction messes up housing markets. There's all sorts of ways in which it's a bit of a disaster. If you're looking for things to put on your nightstand or to put in your Kindle, Edward Glaser's book, The Triumph of the City, is I think an absolutely fantastic read, and he talks about this to a very great deal. I think on one hand, the issue with the mortgage interest deduction is, in a sense, maybe kind of a bit of conservative socialism, but maybe that's kind of turned on its head, because people say, hey, well, we don't want the government to raise your taxes, which is what they might be doing if they eliminated the mortgage interest deduction. Presumably, there should be ways, you should in principle be able to eliminate the mortgage interest deduction and also change the tax structure in such a way by lowering tax rates in order to make it so that those who are losing the mortgage interest deduction are at least as well off as they were before. That can be done in principle. It's going to be very hard to do in practice, and I think it's probably more distributive politics than it is conservative socialism. Where, you know, people basically saying this is going to hit you in the pocketbook and I'm against it is a very good way to get elected. Let's see here. Okay. So the tax deduction for mortgage interest is a redistribution from renters who are usually poorer to homeowners who are usually richer. That is plausible. I'm willing to believe that. But I'm also pretty sure and I don't really know this much about the real estate market. If buying an apartment building is tax deductible, then at least part of that might be passed on in the form of rent. But yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. That in general, the tax deduction for mortgage interest redistributes resources from renters to owners. Renters usually being poorer, owners usually being more wealthy. And I remember in grad school, I had a professor who, when he first really introduced me to framing effects, said, you know, a lot of people say, hey, the mortgage interest deduction is a great idea because you want to give people a break for buying houses. If you turn that around, what the mortgage interest deduction is a way of punishing people for renting. So if you turn it around and say, should we punish people for renting, then we're probably going to get a different outcome. In general, the mortgage interest deduction, yeah, it probably is a net redistribution from the poor to the rich, just like subsidies to higher education are a redistribution from poor taxpayers to college students who are ultimately going to be above average income earners, and the providers of higher education, people like me, who also earn above the average income. Let's see here. Comments about the fact the state has a monopoly over legal coercion yet must enter into voluntary contractual relationships in order to sustain itself. Honestly, I'm not exactly sure what that means. Okay, the fact that the state has a monopoly over legal coercion yet must enter into voluntary contractual relationships in order to... I do think I know what that means. Okay, so the state has a monopoly over voluntary legal coercion. Why don't they just take stuff? Because there's there are at least some market forces, market-like forces, that constrain states' behavior. People can vote with their feet. If I don't like what's going on in the city of Memphis, I can move to one of the suburbs. If I don't like what's going on in the U.S., then I can move to Canada or Mexico or something like that. And eventually, things could get so predatory that people are going to be willing to do that. So there's a competitive constraint. There's an external competitive constraint, meaning that people can move. You know, we can move to Canada, move to Mexico. If you know anything about the Seasteading Institute, we can move to these giant floating seasteads out in the middle of the ocean. Then there are also going to be internal constraints in that, if the government got too out of control, yeah, there'd probably be a violent revolution. Not one that I necessarily want to participate in right now, but if things got bad enough, I'm pretty sure that people would, in fact, go to arms. Okay, so the state is composed of people who voluntarily contract with it and form the state apparatus, yet the apparatus has a monopoly of coercion over everyone else. So I don't think people voluntarily contract with the state. When I filed my tax return recently, I didn't do that. I did that under duress. I didn't do that. I didn't do it voluntarily. Okay. Employees. So employees. Let's see here. Okay. Yes. So the people who actually carry out the state's agenda, they're not slaves of the state. They're employees of the state. I think there's a degree to which that's a little bit ironic. But a lot of people who work for the state are effectively involved in contests with each other over who can redistribute the plunder. I'm teaching a course in public choice economics in the fall. It's going to be a short 2-hour class, and I look forward to getting into that a little bit. I would encourage you to look up research on the economics of bureaucracy, because I have about a minute left, so I want to check out here. Okay, it's the last question. How about the mess in Alabama over electronic bingo, where the conservative governor went after the private gambling concerns, but not the Indian casino? Okay, yeah, that's a perfect example of conservative socialism, or at least American conservative socialism, because it's a type of moral socialism where what people are doing is saying we need the state to go and impose our moral values on others. I have an article that was on Forbes' website. It was before I went weekly last summer, called Crazy. The title of it is Crazy in Alabama. It's the name of a book, the name of a movie too. But it's about the 7th congressional district in Alabama has said, one of the people down there is looking into seceding from the state of Alabama, in part because of precisely this set of issues. That obviously, if you're a member of a racial minority in Alabama, you've not been particularly well served by the state of Alabama, having grown up there, or not grown up there, excuse me, gone to college there, having family there now. I mean, things are a little bit iffy. We should look into things like secession as a viable option. One way that I've said this before is a government that can tell you who you can sleep with is a government that can tell you anything. Can tell you can do it, that can control any aspect of your life. A government that can tell you whether you can or cannot play electronic bingo is a government that can control any aspect of your life. One of the things that I think is tragic about this, from a purely consequentialist perspective, is the sheer array or the sheer quantity of resources that are being wasted by, in this case, the state of Alabama, but also by other states around the country and other governments around the world, trying to control other people's lives, or the amount of resources people are investing trying to prevent states from controlling their lives. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and leave off because I do need to run. But thank you all for your time and your energy and your attention. Send me an email if you have any questions. I hope to have quizzes up soon. Again, like I said, there'll be a final exam in a few weeks, and we'll pick up our discussion next week. We have 2 sessions left. And by the time we're done, we will have, I hope, solved all the problems in the world. So thank you all very much, and I will see you again online 1 week from tonight.